session number 30633, which is James Farquharson, Reel 13. Now, one thing is, what about the social life there? I know it's wartime, but...
We were there, based in Alderan, from early October to earlier, was the sort of second week in January of 45, I think, so quite a few months. And in that time, our troop headquarters was in a house in a sort of square-shaped housing estate, quite isolated, but about a quarter of a mile from the edge of a small village called Alderan. And there, our only social contact that I remember at all was the GP, Dr. Skunzelaar, and his wife, and very small boy who was called Ludo, I remember. And they did their best to entertain us. He used to get his medical ration of absolute alcohol once a month, which he distilled into a very delicious liqueur, which we all enjoyed. And the little boy, Ludo, was allowed complete freedom. He was to come round to us, pushing a little wheelbarrow with a spade to clear the snow off our front path. I've got a photograph of him busy doing this. That was all great entertainment for us. I mean, we enjoyed a little touch of that sort. Otherwise, the only other thing was that in this housing estate also were billeted an American unit who were, in fact, motor mechanics waiting for the Ford plant to be opened in Antwerp, which could only occur when the docks were liberated. And they were under Captain Andrew Athens, and he, to keep them happy, had arranged that they should all be promoted to sergeant. So every one of them was a sergeant, except for the Master Sergeant, Master Sergeant Limeburger, and he was allowed to choose the duty he would like to perform, because he was the senior. So he decided to be the cook, and so he provided the meals. And the others went off in their lorries, I suppose, to sort of prepare the sheds, or whatever it was, where military transport would eventually be assembled and sent out to units. We saw quite a lot of them, and the only memorable thing, I think, was the night of New Year's Eve. Many people who were there will remember that the Germans made their last fling with a surviving aircraft and did a great sweep over Antwerp. Fighters, light bombers and that sort of thing, all doing the best they could with machine guns and bombs. And that evening, the Americans invited us, at least the headquarters, troop headquarters people, I mean about a dozen of us, to go round and join the Hogmanay party. We arrived there and found them almost all blind drunk, with their heads down on the table. Plenty of food around, so we made merry with the food and drink, which was very welcome, because everybody knows that their rations and everything were of much higher quality than ours. And that meant that we went back to bed very late that night, and I remember being woken up by the telephone going, lying in bed, hearing that there was an emergency and a raid. I picked up the phone beside my bed and directed a barrage from my bed. All the guns, by that time, you asked if we had set barrages. By that time, we had. They were called radial zone.
Now, tell me about these. How did these radial zone barrages work?
Now, the radial zone barrages, I've still got one or two bits and pieces to do with. It was done by a large sheet of plastic, I remember, with a sort of circle on it, what do you call it, a sort of protractor of double size, 360 degrees, and you had a ruler marked off, and you somehow put the ruler on the on the protractor, and so plotted out, pre-plotted, of course, all the different directions of barrage, and each gun then was given a series of letters: go to radial zone barrage A or B, and so on. And they set the gun at a certain angle, and whatever it was, I ordered the barrage like that, and I'm glad to say that somebody was awake on all the, I think on all the gun positions, and I suppose I was the duty officer that night because I did the whole troop, and they went to action stations, and in fact, as always, they didn't get a shot at anything. One of our officers in another troop happened to be staying a night with a girlfriend in a flat in Antwerp. He claims that he went up onto the roof of the flat and shot a German pilot plane down with his revolver. And all that we saw, really, we heard this roar of the planes going by, and one fighter, a Messerschmitt, did in fact come down just in front of us. There was a stretch of polder meadow between us and the edge of Audran village, I mean, about 200 or 300 yards, I suppose. And in that space, this plane came down and sort of skidded along in the mud and came to a standstill. And I suppose, I really don't remember now whether we captured the pilot or whether he was dead or what happened, but the whole thing was outside, out of our hands, really. It just came down, and we looked out of the window and goggled at it, and other people came to sort it out, I think. But that was about one of the few excitements we had in that long period. I think there's... one other thing to say, yes, which is of significance. I mentioned that... After we were at Lark Hill as depot regiment, and the guns had all been polished and all a lot of nonsense like that, I think that led to the removal of our CO. I don't know what happened to him. And he was replaced by a Clive Blaber, B-L-A-B-E-R, who was a brigadier staff officer, I suppose, and at his request had been demoted to lieutenant colonel so as to command a unit in the field. He was a very high-grade regular soldier. I mean, he really was a man you respected. He was an ideal CO, and he joined us. Well, he certainly was there at the time of D-Day, and he, I think, had joined us before that. But anyhow, not so very long after we arrived in Antwerp, he had been invited to have Sunday lunch with the mayor and mayoress of a little local market town just outside Antwerp called Merxem, M-E-R-X-E-M. And apparently, after lunch, they went out for a stroll in the garden, he between the mayor and the mayoress. A V-2 rocket fell and killed him and didn't damage either of them. And that was the end of our excellent CO. It was a much felt in the unit generally. And he was replaced by another, I think, ex-regular soldier called, well, we always called him Bill Sykes. He was Sykes anyhow, who was, again, not up to that quality, and he was there for the rest of my time with the unit.
What do you remember of Sykes? What was he like? What was not quite so good about him?
It's difficult to say. I mean, he certainly wasn't the same commanding figure of a man. Blaber was a chap you took to at once, and you instinctively felt that he was, you know, trustworthy. Sykes hadn't got that quality quite. He was just the sort of chap in the background. I'm not sure that he came round to see us very much. Braber was very assiduous at that. I mean, he really showed his face to the other ranks, which was always a most important thing. So I can't say much about Sykes. I hardly knew him. This was the period of the Battle of the Bulge.
The Ardennes Offensive.
Ardennes, yes. Which was, I can't remember now whether it was began before Christmas.
Just before, I think.
Oh, yes. Well, that was a period of intense cold. We had snow on the ground, and the temperature was right down. I mean, it really was absolutely freezing. And we were put at the ready, and orders came round that I can't remember what we were supposed to do if they came round, but there were two code words. Milk, which meant airborne operations imminent. It was expected, you see, the Germans would fly in and cut off the whole salient and capture Antwerp. Cream, which meant airborne operations in force. And so we all sat waiting for milk or cream, and we got cream in the end, which was a terrible mistake. Somebody didn't read the code book properly or something, so we all leapt to our guns and that sort of thing, stood trembling, waiting what was going to happen next. And nothing happened, of course. But I suppose, yes, once that battle was out of the way, which would have been very soon after New Year, preparations were begun to clear the last bit of enemy-held land this side of the Rhine. By that time, of course, the Germans had been cleared out of the mouth of the Scheldt, principally by the Canadian army. Well, I think the Canadian army dealt with the Belgian side. Actually, I think it's part of Holland, but the left bank of the mouth of the Scheldt. And as soon as they cleared that, I think the Germans on the opposite bank went off and moved away. So I suppose they realized that they couldn't defend the entrance to the river with just one protecting one side. And the docks then opened, and ships began coming in, and everything sprang to life. But to do with the Reichsfeld battle, which it was called, places called Cleves, Clever, where Anne of Cleves came from, Xanten, X-A-N-T-E-N, and Goch, I think G-O-C-H, were the three little towns along that stretch of country west of the Rhine. And the idea, January the 23rd springs to mind. That was probably the day to launch the offensive. And we were moved up before that to Nijmegen. N-I-J-M-E-G-E-N. And I suppose we were deployed there. I chiefly remember our troop headquarters on a common on the edge of the town. Where the other ranks were, I don't know. But there we were, anyhow. Yes, we must have been deployed in some way to give air defense. We were shelled by the Germans, the only time I think we ever came under enemy shell fire.
Now, what was that like for
you? It was unpleasant. I mean, you heard a whizzing noise and a bang somewhere, and you weren't sure that the next one wasn't coming your way. And but it didn't interfere with our duties and our general existence. It was just a slight anxiety. And this offensive, which was supposed to take 3 days, I think, to clear all this area, took, I think, 3 weeks, because of a combination of things. First, very bad and wet weather, and also that I think the Germans released the river to flood the land. I mean, a great deal of the waterways were above ground level, of course, protected by dikes and that sort of thing. And so I seem to remember that one of the main routes, there were pretty poor roads into that area, it was a forest area, there was at least one place where the road was flooded, and our troops somehow ingeniously had got a cross-river ferry, a sort of car ferry with flaps at each end, you know, and ramps and so on, and had brought that into action along the road. So all the transport had to load on these things, be ferried across and put out on the other side. Of course, meant the progress was incredibly slow and the queues were immensely long. And that slowed the thing up, and eventually they did clear the area. And after that, I remember going with my fellow officers on a, what we called a swanning expedition. We weren't exactly looting, but we went off to see what, we went to Cleves, actually, to Claver, to see what it was like and to feel, of course, that was German soil. So it was the first time we were actually in Germany. And it was just an afternoon trip. And I don't know if I should mention this, but my troop commander, Peter Darcy, managed to get a canteen of silver plate, I think it was, in a wooden chest out from the cellar of a deserted house, loaded it up in the back of his Jeep, and we went off with it. And there were consequences of that later on, I mean, in a mild way. We then drove back, and the next stage, of course, was the preparation for the crossing of the Rhine, and we were moved back to Nijmegen was on the southern branch of the main Rhine. What were they? I can't remember. One was called the Lech, and the other called, okay, I forget now, but it's all on maps. Arnhem was, of course, the one at the north, then Nijmegen, the southern branch of the Rhine. And then south of that, about the same distance, Grave, Grave, which was the bridge over the Meuse, or the Maas, as it was called, that MAAS. And we were deployed there to protect the surviving bridge. And there, the bridge was one of those bridges that was a sort of box girder. It had cross beams overhead, and we had the amusement of watching the Royal Navy going through with their enormous barges, with officers standing at the salute on the bridge and that sort of thing, only just getting through under the cross girders, going at a snail's pace. And there was nothing else for us. We just sat there with our guns in position, no action at all. And now, let me think. Was it there? Yes, that would the crossing of the Rhine, probably about March the 24th or something like that.
I think so, yes.
Yes. I have a feeling that the supply of V1s dried up during that period, and the very last ones were launched by the Germans from north of Arnhem, I mean north of the river, short of fuel. And they used to come, it was a really rather unpleasant, probably only one day or something like that, but these things came with their wings wobbling to and fro, very low down, making a sort of unpleasant crackling noise, and coming down here and there and going off.
So they were short-range attacks, running out of fuel.
I should say that they weren't serious attacks at all. I mean, it was just a desperate effort. They got them there. They might as well send them off somewhere. And I think that was the end of all V weapon attacks. After the Rhine had been crossed, we were moved up to Arnhem.
And do you remember anything about the Rhine crossing?
we weren't involved in it at all.
Could you see it going on?
We didn't see it going. I mean, we just heard about it on the news or read about it in the paper, more or less. Now, while we were at Nijmegen, we were able to, the officers were able to go to an officers' club at a place I think called Wesel, W-E-S-E-L, which gave us a little social life for a change.
What was the club like?
I don't remember anything about the club except that I did bump into various old acquaintances and school friends from other units and things like that. It was quite an enjoyable experience. I remember driving away in my Jeep from it one evening, and the second, on two occasions in those days, there were trenches being dug across the road for repairs or something with no barriers or anything, and we just set off and it bang, suddenly the front end of the Jeep went straight down. I banged my head against the windscreen, I think. We didn't suffer serious harm. There were other people coming away from the club as well, and they all rallied round and got us out, pulled the Jeep up out of the trench, and away we went. That happened once to me in Nijmegen, a curious evening when we gave a dance for the local girls in a hall somewhere, and our three batmen were given the job of manning the cloakroom, which was just a trestle table in the side room, and all the people came in and threw their coats down there and that sort of thing. I suppose refreshments were provided of some sort. We had a useful regimental band which used to go round. A chap called Reg Cadell ran it, and I think that was roped in to play the music. And when the dance was over, we said good night to all the people who went out and that sort of thing, and then went back to collect our coats, and every single thing had been taken. I lost a fine raincoat and things like that, and nothing was left. And there's nothing we could do about it. It's just all gone. But I had, in fact, by that time I was wearing something I was very proud of, an American fleece-lined jacket with a hood. And I put that on, drove my girlfriend from the dance back to her house on this common where we were stationed. She was called Maya McRanda, I remember, descended from Scots. And I saw her to her door. I'd taken off my jacket, presumably. It was lying in the Jeep. Saw her to her door, said good night to her, let her in, and went back to the Jeep, and the blessed coat wasn't there. So somebody had nipped it round and nicked it. And then I drove away and fell into a trench again in the road. No lights, no barriers or anything. And fortunately, there was a searchlight unit nearby, and I went to them for help. This was dead of night. And they came out with a winch lorry, a sort of thing that ran the cables up and down barrage balloons or something also, I think they had also. And they managed to haul me out. And that was the end of that little episode, anyhow. There were many other amusing things. Now, we went up to Arnhem, and there we were again housed in a housing estate, rather similar to the one at Orderon, only right up against the high approach to the great bridge, which had been blown, of course, by the Germans, and protected from the river again by a high bank, a dike, as they called it. And the guns were deployed on the other side of the approach to the bridge, in farmland, absolutely lovely. By that time, this was early April, of course, apple blossom everywhere, sunshine, nothing much to do except wait for the word go. The gunners used to go canoeing on a pond there, and one of them fell out and was drowned, Gunner Taylor, T-A-Y-L-E-R, I remember, which was from my troop, the very first death. We'd lost, as I said earlier, we lost a sergeant who was injured at Arromanches, but that was the only other casualty at that stage. And anyhow, came the day of the assault on Arnhem. This was very interesting because, of course, the British army was well over the Rhine. They approached from the east to the town, having to cross a river called the Isel, I-J-S-E-L-L, I think, which was, in fact, a small branch of the Rhine that ran out into the Zuider Zee northwards, I think. They said it had no difficulty in crossing that. But we were facing the whole town from the south, totally concealed by a great flood bank. You could climb up it and look over. There wasn't very much of interest, except you could see a built-up area, church towers and that sort of thing. And on the, was it the 14th, something like that, of April, anyhow, along the road behind this farm, there was a sort of narrow road, again, raised up, where was a smoke screen. At intervals along the road, there was a trailer parked at the side of the road with an enormous vertical drum on it, with smoke pouring out of the top. And in each case, I think, one man in attendance, sitting up on a sort of raised seat, fast asleep usually. And in the evening of the day, the attack, it was in daylight still. Perhaps it was 6:40 or something like that. It wouldn't have been 8:40. The first moves were to douse the smoke screen, to blow down all the numerous electric cables, grid pylons, carrying electricity from a power station in Nijmegen, yes, taking the power northwards, because we were supplying the Germans with their electricity. And also, they ran the telephone exchange. So if I wanted to ring a friend in another unit, I rang through a German, said, well, a number, please, and that sort of thing, and you had to say it in German, and you were put through. It was an absolutely crazy thing, which few people would remember now, probably. And anyhow, the result of blowing down all these cables was that nobody had any power anywhere at all for days, if not weeks afterwards. And that was followed by an immense gun barrage, a typical Monty effort.
What did it look like? What could you see of the barrage?
Oh, well, you could hear the shells going over, of course, but you could also see these great sort of sheets of rockets being fired behind them. Fearful noise, and they roared up into the sky and went over. Our task was to fire tracer over this dike on a prearranged angle, I suppose. And I don't think we moved it, but it was something with marking off the approach of the troops on the far side of the river. And I simply can't remember how or why we did it. You'd think that we would be moving in front of them all the time to show them how far they'd got, more or less. But we did this somehow. And